China is hoping that what it's seeing is an economic slowdown.
And not an economic meltdown.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Friday, April the 13th.
Coming up, two big banks report strong earnings thanks in part to a boost in mortgage lending.
Lessons learned from the Titanic 100 years after its sinking.
And savor your lunch break. You may not be taking it for much longer.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
The last 3 months in China were the worst for the country's economic growth since early 2009. 8.1% GDP compared with 8.9% last quarter. Now, if 8.1% sounds like a good number, it would be here in the U.S. where growth was just 3% at last check. But this is China we're talking about, a country with an economy that is still developing.
The BBC's Juliana Liu is with us now from Hong Kong to go behind the numbers. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what's being seen as the cause of this slowdown?
Well, exports out of China are slowing because demand in places like Europe and the US are weaker than it has been before. But really, what's driving the slowdown in China is the property market. In the last 10 years, property prices have gone up by more than tenfold. And you can imagine that makes a lot of people very angry because they're being priced out of the property market. So in response to that, the Chinese government has been trying to slow housing inflation. And that, in effect, is what's causing the slowdown in the overall economy that we're seeing now.
And I have to say, when I hear something like that over here in the United States, it sounds like you're experiencing something very similar to what we did right before our big financial crash with housing prices just going up, up, up.
Absolutely. That's certainly the big fear. And that property bubble bursting in the States has offered a lot of lessons to policymakers in China. So they're absolutely trying to avoid something like that, which is why this slowdown is very much a government-guided effort. But the real worry is that in some areas, perhaps this effort has already gone too far. We heard this week that a property developer has declared bankruptcy for the first time because of a lack of access to credit. So the worry is if a lot of property developers go bankrupt, would that have the same effect as a hard landing?
The BBC's Juliana Liu in Hong Kong. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
While we're talking China, there's an ongoing story captivating that country that involves a man who was until recently a rising star within the ruling party, his spouse, and a British businessman who turned up dead in a Chinese hotel room. The wife is suspected of murder. Her charismatic husband, Bo Xilai, is disgraced, his political power neutralized, and now the investigation is reportedly looking into financial corruption. The New York Times reports the wealth of this former power couple is now in the crosshairs. Bill Bishop is a U.S. business consultant in Beijing. Mr. Bishop, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. This is a major story, right? People are paying attention in China to this. Give me a sense here about the fact that the story seems to be now moving into the financial arrangements of the couple in question.
Well, that's one of the things I think that people are most fascinated about. You know, most people here assume that there's a fairly high level of corruption. And so now as details come out, I think people are quite interested in some of the dealings, and there's not really a surprise that there's corruption. And so I think what we're actually going to see is even more details coming out and more calls in the media talking about just how bad this guy was and how, you know, everyone has to rally around the party and the party's unified and we're moving forward and everything is great.
And you think it's about politics? In other words, making sure that this guy's career is truly ended?
Well, yeah, I think at this point there are very few people, if anyone, who think that he can actually recover from this. Certainly, politics is a big part of it. I think some of the reports in the Western media about sort of, you know, factionalism and hardline, softline kind of stuff is a bit overblown. This is also about the arrangements for the next group of leaders that's going to be decided sometime this fall at the 18th Communist Party Congress. But it's politics. It's also money and influence. And I mean, I think the ideological positions of these guys are actually, I think, much closer together than most people would have you believe.
Bill Bishop is a U.S. business consultant in Beijing. Mr. Bishop, thank you.
Thank you.
With the economy of China stuck in third gear, the U.S. stuck in first, and Europe in reverse, Where in the world does a savvy investor find some growth? Marketplace's John Dimsdale has that story.
Would you believe the next hot market is Vietnam or Peru? The latest survey of private equity investors shows that increasingly the smart money is heading for so-called frontier markets. The survey is done by the Emerging Markets Private Equity Association, whose president is Sarah Alexander.
Nigeria is being looked at very closely, as is Kenya, as is Botswana.
She says the financial crisis proved wealthy countries are riskier than many thought, and that's making investors more comfortable with some out-of-the-way places.
The biggest barrier to an investor going into a market the first time is political and economic risk, or the perception of that risk. The fact these investors are moving their money suggests that they really have a much better sense of real risks in these markets.
There's also potential in one country you wouldn't think is a frontier market. Greece, she says, offers isolated opportunities for the adventurous investor. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Here in the U.S., we've heard a lot about Trayvon Martin, the shooting in Florida, and that state's Stand Your Ground law that allows people to use force if they feel threatened. Well, today in St. Louis, the law will come under the spotlight as the National Rifle Association holds its annual convention. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
The NRA has pushed Stand Your Ground laws in more than 30 states. Wisconsin recently expanded self-defense to include a vehicle, swimming pool, or business. The NRA spent about $100,000 lobbying there. Lisa Graves of the Center for Media and Democracy says the NRA has an impressive war chest.
But I think the NRA's potency is really more the potential for it to run ads against candidates who don't go along with the gun agenda.
The NRA may face a battle to defend Stand Your Ground laws. The Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence told me their public support is up. Gun owners are buying more guns. Industry analyst Jim Barrett says they're afraid President Obama will roll back gun rights in a second term.
It is an absolutely fabulous market. Take Sturm Ruger.
They make the Black Hawk revolver.
Their unit sales were up 52%. Smith & Wesson sales were up 24%.
Barrett says sales are booming in states where the NRA has pushed concealed carry laws. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
Two big banks reported earnings this morning. J.P. Morgan Chase beat expectations with reports of a $5.4 billion profit last quarter, and Wells Fargo made $4.2 billion in profit. Both banks report an uptick in mortgage lending.
And that's where we'll start with Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial. He joins us now from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Chris, J.P. Morgan says mortgage loans grew about 33% compared with last year, and it was pretty much the same story over at Wells Fargo. What's going on here?
Well, that's right. These are the two big banks that are way out in front of their competitors in terms of cleaning up the mortgage mess that they had on their books from the 08-09 financial collapse. And now they've moved forward to sort of focus on generating new business. J.P. Morgan had a loss in mortgages a year ago. This quarter, they've got a really nice gain, a lot of it refinancing.
All right. Well, another story that I'm sure will come up here when we talk about the big banks is that they put aside less money for losses, as they have been doing quarter after quarter, which is one way that people say banks can beef up the look of their profits. So are we getting the full story from these profits?
I think we are. You know, they're setting aside less for losses because their losses really are that much smaller. All banks in the U.S. went through some of the biggest earnings hits that they've ever seen, most of them at least since the 1930s anyway, during the financial crisis. I think what really speaks well for their preparedness is that the Federal Reserve just did a pretty dramatic test, a stress test of their books. What they've determined is that banks are actually, they've set aside enough, they're in better financial shape than they were even during the previous boom. So I'm not worried about that.
Chris, quickly, let me just ask you about one other thing. Google said it's going to split its stock. Can you explain what that means quickly and why Google's doing it?
Well, for Google, it's a little weird. But basically what they're doing is that the shareholders who currently own the stock at about $630 will get two shares valued at half of that for each one that they own. The reason it's weird is that one of those shares is going to be the existing class. Another will be a non-voting class. They're doing two things. One is that they are making the shares cheaper so more people can afford to buy them. The other is that they're maintaining control for founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin, who want to make sure that the company can be nimble and innovative.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
This weekend, as you've probably heard by now, marks the 100 years since the Titanic sank. The tragedy continues to fascinate and to provide lessons for managing big projects even today. Jennifer Hooper-McCarty is a materials scientist and co-author of What Really Sank the Titanic? And she says it's not the usual short answer. Ms. McCarty, good morning.
Good morning.
I watch all these science programs, so I know that the Titanic sank because it hit an iceberg, right? You're saying it's more complicated than that?
It's definitely more complicated. We can track the history of the construction of the ship and take a close look at the materials to help us understand why the ship sank the way it did.
You think there was, like, what? Shoddy construction, maybe?
You could say that. I try not to use those words, but I have taken a careful look at the materials that make up the rivets on the ship, and the rivets are sort of like two-headed nails that hold the steel plates on the ship together. And the wrought iron that the rivets were made from was substandard for the time period. And the problem with that is when the wrought iron isn't high enough quality, when it feels certain stresses, in this case, when the iceberg collided with the ship, the heads on those rivets will pop. And as a result, the seams of the ship can open up like a zipper.
How did it come to pass that the rivets might have been substandard? Was it a cost-saving thing or just a mistake?
What I think happened was the sister ship, the Olympic, needed to be repaired. So they had many employees that were taken off of the Titanic to repair the Olympic. And also that riveters preferred to rivet iron rather than steel, which was a stronger material, because it was easier to rivet and they could do it faster.
Jennifer Hooper-McCarty is a materials scientist and co-author of What Really Sank the Titanic. Jennifer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
California has been the birthplace of a lot of national standards. Think fuel efficiency for cars or smoking bans for public places. Well, now it may be time to add lunch breaks to the list. The California Supreme Court has ruled that while employers have to offer workers a lunch break, they don't have to make sure employees actually take a lunch break. Marketplace's Eve Troe reports.
Okay, I confess. I eat lunch at my desk while checking email for work. Not great for digestion, I know, but not great for the economy either, says labor scholar Harley Shaken at UC Berkeley.
People could be more stressed and where service erodes as a result of this.
Service, or the service industry, is what spawned this case. Workers for Brinker International, the company that owns Chili's restaurants, were allowed to take breaks, but said they didn't feel they could because they'd leave coworkers stranded. The workers wanted bosses to tell them, hey, take your break, no working. The company's attorneys said that would violate employees' freedom to use their time how they want. The court sided with Chili's owners. So my bosses can't make me stop checking email at lunch.
In a very competitive world, there will be considerable pressures that lead workers to want to show they're a model employee by working through their lunch break.
When no meal break becomes workplace culture, Shaken says, the right to take lunch can't compete with the pressure not to. And that could spread around the country. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Now to Scotland, where there's been a natural gas leak going on in the North Sea for weeks, and there are concerns about the effect that's having on fish. So, David, you know what they do? They bring in the taste testers, these seafood specialists in Scotland that will first take an initial deep inhalation of the fish, followed by one or two shallower sniffs. Then they taste the fish, spit it into a cup, have a biscuit and some water. And so far, the verdict is the fish are okay.
Well, that sounds scientific. Word this morning that consumer prices in the U.S. went up 0.3% in March. Gas prices were up. Electricity prices, though, were down. Inflation has been more tame in recent months after a spike last fall. In Britain's capital today, the mayor blocked an anti-gay group from putting ads on London buses. Joining us from London is Marketplace's Stephen Beard. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, David.
So what are these ads?
A Christian group called Core Issues Trust paid about $15,000 to place the ads on around 20 London buses. These ads essentially promoted the idea that gay people can be helped to give up their homosexuality and should do so. The ads were in fact a response to an earlier advertising campaign by a gay rights group supporting the British government's plans for gay marriage.
So how did the mayor get involved in this?
Well, news of the ad campaign got out. It triggered a Twitter storm, and the mayor, who's facing an election campaign at the moment, stepped in and ordered his transport chief to pull the ads. He said, London is one of the most tolerant cities in the world and intolerant of intolerance. However, Mike Davidson, the man who placed the ads, says he's been denied freedom of speech.
I think it's very concerning that this level of censorship still exists, particularly in a city that claims to be so tolerant.
He says the mayor is seeking favour with gay voters in London, and the group Index on Censorship, which campaigns for freedom of speech, has criticised the mayor's ban. It says it's part of a trend to shut down controversial issues rather than have a debate about them.
All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thank you very much.
Okay, David.
We're always reporting on the strain on the housing market these days, but what about the barriers we put up to protect our homes? According to a new Wall Street Journal report, security gates are getting more advanced than ever, and business is really booming for those who fortify.
Here to speak with us for our Midday Extra is Lauren Shuker of the Wall Street Journal. She's with us from New York. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us what's going on with the home security industry.
So we're seeing sort of homeowners put increasing demands for privacy and security on companies. And we're seeing a lot of kind of elaborate security gates with the accoutrements like cameras and alarms being installed around the country. And business is booming. I mean, ADT, you know, which is the largest kind of alarm system in the market, you know, measures it. And it's really expanded from about $11.3 billion in 2006 to $12.5 billion in 2011. And it's hard to know what's causing some of the growth. I mean, some experts say that with the advent, you know, of the internet, it's easier to sort of look up people's homes and find them online, and that's made homeowners more paranoid. So what we're seeing is they're building, you know, elaborate security gates outside their homes. They don't always look spectacular, like the wrought iron gates of Versailles, but they're laden with, you know, 25 or 35 cameras that a homeowner can hook up to their iPad, and so they can kind of monitor the perimeter of their home while they're flying in their private jet or wherever they are.
Well, I'm going to probably voice what some of our listeners are thinking right now. Some of this must be an outgrowth of income inequality in the United States, wouldn't you think?
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of there are a couple of very high-end gate makers who really specialize in home security. And they think that, too. I mean, the gate is really – a lot of them told me the gate is a sign of affluence. It's sort of a symbol in our culture of having an estate. I mean, the sort of the history of the gate, of course, you know, comes from when cities would wall themselves off to protect from intruders. And I think a lot of what we're seeing now is the 1% sort of walling off their estates, in part just because of the growing disparity between people in the U.S.
And in your reporting, are you seeing this happening all over the country, or is it in certain areas only?
It is happening all over the country. You know, of course, it's different styles. I mean, in Los Angeles, when you drive around, what you're seeing a lot of is very drab entrances or sort of toned-down gates that are high and kind of very protective, but not ornate. And a lot of security experts in L.A. said that's sort of part of the outgrowth of, you know, celebrities at one time had very ornate gates outside their home, and it's actually more secure to have a more discreet entrance. Hmm. But, you know, in Palm Beach, if you drive down, you know, some of the ritzy streets there, you see some of the most spectacular, enormous gates. And even in New York, they're, you know, on the Upper East Side, a lot of townhouses are investing in expensive bronze gates. So it's really all over, but it takes different forms.
And one of the conclusions I note in your piece is that just because a gate doesn't look all that fancy doesn't mean it might not have some pretty high technology behind it.
That's right. I mean, part of what has happened is, you know, according to these gate makers, homeowners are making gates that are a little bit less ornate. And there's been a move towards, you know, making gates that look a little more normal. But that doesn't really mean that there isn't as much or more security within them. A lot of these cameras have gotten very tiny, sort of pinhole size, and can be hidden. You know, you can have a camera in a tree that is actually capturing license plates as they drive into the property, but it's impossible to see. There are barking dog alarms that, you know, sound intimidating, but are sort of invisible. So it's very hard to tell, you know, from the outside how girded an estate is against intruders.
Now, Lauren, one last thing I want to ask, because I guess anecdotally, I feel like about 50% of the security cameras I see are never actually checked by anyone and don't probably even work. Did you find out whether these cameras are for real?
Yes. I mean, look, it's hard to always put this in a piece because you don't want to expose people's personal
right.
security too much or put them in danger. But yes, I think a lot of these devices have gotten so complex. Some homeowners told me that they removed cameras from their perimeter because they were getting too many alarms set off, too many signals. Yes, and, you know, a lot of these, you know, the gate, as a lot of people told me, it's really just a deterrent. I mean, a gate can't really keep anyone out. There's no gate to the sky. So a lot of these cameras, these big gates, these alarm systems, you know, these dogs are really just deterrents in hopes that you will ward off intruders. But, you know, as everyone told me, even when, you know, in gated communities where Arnold Schwarzenegger lives and Tom Brady, when news breaks, helicopters still, you know, come very close to the properties. You can't keep everyone out all the time, no matter how big your gate is.
Lauren Sugar of the Wall Street Journal, thank you very much for this.
Thanks.
And finally, good old Harry Potter has been good to British author J.K. Rowling, who's now worth an estimated $989 million after those 7 books. But when the net worth gets close to $1 billion, an artist can afford to try something new. The publisher Little Brown has now revealed the tales of Rowling's first new book since 2007. The synopsis seems light on Quidditch potential. It'll be called The Casual Vacancy, and it's about an idyllic English town torn apart by elections for town council.
And it'll probably be a bestseller. I'm going out on a limb here. I think that it might actually do pretty well.
She is a strong brand.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.